The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn
Beck. Okay, hear me out on this just for a second. What do you think? Constitutional amendment that has an inclusion rider. So, you know, if we're going to get together, we're going to do anything, we just got to check the rider, formerly known as the Constitution. And who do we need to include? There is a really ugly, hypocritical side to the prolonged cultural moment that America is having regarding issues of gender and race, and that is a growing hostility to a specific group of people, even as it includes every other group, you know, and preaches to them that you have to include every other group. It's becoming so absurd that even a nerdy conference for history professors at Stanford is being, you know, billed as too white and too male. Last week, a female history professor at Harvard University tweeted some screenshots of several of the speakers at this history conference and wrote, quote, "All male history conference. This goes for the Guinness Book of the Century." I bet not. I bet there's probably more white people that have attended another conference. I'm not sure. "A team of 30 white male historians will discuss applied history at Stanford. What a shame." Now, I don't think she means that it's a shame that they're getting together to discuss history or how to apply it. I think she thinks it's a shame because this group of 30 are all white men. She repeated this sentiment over several days, calling the gathering shameful as if it was a Klan history conference. Other female professor critics agreed until finally the browbeating affected the conference director, Niall Ferguson, who is a great historian. He apologized, saying, "We did discuss diversity ahead of time and have invited several women, but they were all unable to attend. But even that being said, we, quote, must redouble our efforts to represent diverse viewpoints in future conferences," end quote. Yeah, you want a diverse look at history? Invite me. Yeah, because see, even though I am a white man, I bet I disagree with a lot of the other white men that are in that conference. Like, we don't have diverse viewpoints? Is it all about the color of our skin and what we have in our pants? Because I think I remember something like Martin Luther King saying something different. That we were all supposed to remember and celebrate. And I do. Does anybody else anymore? The current cultural climate. Ferguson had to say something for self-preservation purposes. Are we really all this bored and this self-absorbed that we now have to find white privilege villainy in every nook and cranny of culture? Why are the dark sides of Oreos on the outside? And there's a white filling that, what, holds it together? Well, you're telling me that two dark cookies couldn't hold themselves together? Well, no, in this case, we're talking a cookie. No! Progressives have done a masterful job of turning diversity into their highest virtue. And now that they've achieved that, they're just showing you that, you know, you will be diverse, or we'll eliminate those voices that aren't diverse enough. Oh, okay. All right. Americans all believe different things. And we've been told we should celebrate all those different things that we believe. Now we're being told only celebrate those things that the group leaders tell you we can celebrate. The most important thing, and I remember hearing people saying this when I was a kid, instead of focusing on all of the things that divide us, why not focus on a few of the things that unite us? I think that there is still a large section, maybe 80% of this country, left and right, that really are kind of spooked by this diversity policing. They're really kind of spooked by, we want diverse voices, except for those, get them off campus. And if they won't leave, well, throw a Molotov cocktail through a J. Crew window. I think we're all kind of freaked out by that. Diversity policing by citizen cops on social media is a danger to a free society. Of all the people you would think that would get this, you would think that it would be a group of really smart history professors. No, it's not. It's not. Wow.
It's Monday, March 19th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Wanted to get one of my favorite self-made historians, Brad Meltzer, on the phone, talk about this and his new book, The Escape Artist, which, Brad, I have to tell you, I finished reading, you know, after your interview. I hate having people on and not reading their book. But I it took me, I think, 2 days to read it, and I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning. Thank you. And it was fantastic. The reason why I was up till three is I could not stop reading it. It's a great book.
I appreciate it. I mean, you know, you and I were emailing afterwards, and, you know, I said to you that the most intimate thing in life is being understood and understanding someone else. And you have always just completely gotten what I'm doing. And especially with this book, the emotion that went behind and the history that went behind this, it really did change me. You read it immediately. You wrote to me and said, this book, I feel like it's changed you. And you can't go to Dover Air Force Base and see, you know, some of the most amazing heroes in our society and leave unchanged.
So the message that I wrote to you where I said, this, I think, is almost a reinvention or a re-pointing on the compass of not only your course, but also the action adventure kind of books. You know, the Jason Bourne kind of book has been done over and over and over again. This is deeper and different. Do you understand that? And how would you explain that?
Yeah, no, I do. I very much understand it because I've been writing for, you know, this is my 20th year writing thrillers. And you and I met, you know, right at the beginning of that career. And usually you write a thriller and, you know, the good guy has to beat the bad guy. And that's basically what the fight is about. And in this book, if I'm really being honest, this book was a transaction like any other. You know, I've done the secret tunnels below the White House. I've done the hidden labyrinth below the Capitol. I thought when I got after my USO tour in the Middle East, I thought that when I went to Dover Air Force Base, it was just going to be like that. I'd walk in. They would tell me some cool stuff. I would write a thriller where the good guys beat the bad guys. And when I got there, I was humble, Glenn. I was humbled by what I saw, by watching these people who take care of our fallen soldiers at Dover Air Force Base. And we all know, you know, Dover's that place where we're used to those flag-covered coffins coming off the planes. What I didn't realize was that Dover has the biggest cases. It's where, whether it's on 9/11, the Pentagon flight victims went, the space shuttle victims when the space shuttle goes down. But again, what you and I just quickly talked about was those people that take care of those who no one knows about, the spies, our 007s across the country. We've seen in the CIA headquarters, there's stars right behind on the wall. And they say these stars represent fallen soldiers, fallen CIA members who no one can know their name. And the people at Dover know their name because they're rebuilding them when their bodies come back. And to watch them rebuild someone's hand because a mother says, I want to hold my son's hand one last time. Or to rebuild someone's jaw for 14 hours because they say, you know what, I want this family to be able to recognize and see their son or daughter off one last time. That's humbling.
You write in the book that's not part of their job. That's things that they decide to do, that each of the examiners or the forensics guys, they take their time to do it.
Yeah, the one that I just said to you, 14 hours rewiring someone's jaw, I didn't make that up. That really happened. And the person who did it didn't take overtime for it. They can, 14 hours, but they didn't take overtime because they saw it as a mission. And when I saw that, I knew I wasn't writing a thriller about good guys and bad guys anymore, but I was writing about some of the most important ways we deal with life and look out for each other. And the battles that my character Zig is facing with the loss of a child, with the loss of, you know, trying to reclaim what that hole in his chest will never be able to be filled with, was just bigger than anything I've written about. And I'll tell you this, I couldn't tell you this before because I didn't know it, I was on book tour last week, and I stopped in Miami, in my hometown now, and a woman said to me, you know, Brad, I've read all your books. And she said, and they're usually about some kind of, you know, hard luck kid who basically is trying to get to that next level, the Supreme Court, the White House, whatever the next level is. And then they just eventually kind of can't get there. Or when they do get there, they realize it's just not as amazing as they thought it was going to be. And she said, is that right? And my mother-in-law was in the front row. And my mother-in-law laughed and said, huh. But she knew that's my life. And I said to the woman, I said, that's my life. You know, I came from, you know, very modest beginnings. I was the first in my family to go to college. That was my life. I said, you're absolutely right, ma'am. I said, but this book is not that. And what I realized in the last week, without even thinking about it, is what I was writing from is a new perspective. It was the perspective of being a father. Mm-hmm. I never did that before. Mm-hmm. And now I had Zig being this father who's, you know, again, trying to put to rest all these fallen sons and daughters. And the result was I wrote from my mature place, from what happened over 20 years. I've grown somehow, some way. And I wish I was smart enough to know I was doing that. But I think what you're feeling is that same love you have for your kids, that same love I have for my kids, that's more powerful than any kind of, yeah, you know, trying to achieve something that we'll ever do.
Talking to Brad Meltzer, he is a fantastic writer and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Escape Artist, which is out now. And it's just, it's fantastic. One of the better books that I've read in a long time. Brad, I want to change the subject just a little bit and talk to you about, have you seen what's happening with Facebook and the algorithms and how they are taking information and using it? I'm trying to find one story here.
I've seen it, of course. This is okay. Incredible. I was obsessed with this story all weekend. I said, I want to go, you know, if you look at my Twitter feed, right, the day after the election, it was like a day or two after the election, I said, the greatest story that is not being told right now, it's so obvious now, but I said it then, was how the Russians played with our election and played mm-hmm. with us. And again, whatever you want to see. And people were like, oh, you're taking, I'm like, I'm not taking sides. It's just mathematical facts. And over the weekend, a story came out that very high level, not only Russian, but also Republican. And again, Democrats were, you know, they gave it to Democrats too. Democrats just hadn't invited it. I mean, they didn't see the opportunity, but were able to take our Facebook data. And by answering, you know, those little quizzes that they say, are you a happy person? Are you a pessimistic person? Describe yourself. They put these kind of quizzes out on Facebook. And in figuring out these quizzes and what people clicked on, they could figure out our personalities and therefore figure out what we're susceptible to, what kind of ads we're susceptible to, what kind of things could convince us. And it becomes this, you know, and you know that I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think we confuse the word conspiracy with kooky and crazy. This is something that really happened in America. When you have big data out there and information on Facebook out there, and we're constantly liking things and clicking things, eventually it gives you a profile of who we are. And if you can take all those millions of profiles of people, you can figure out how to influence them. And the thing that I think upsets all of us is we don't like, you know, it's like subliminal advertising. We don't like being influenced without us knowing we're being influenced. And that's what they did here.
So I want to come back, take a quick break, and I want to talk to you about a new algorithm that I am really concerned about. It came out in Bloomberg this weekend, and it is something that I have read about in, you know, all the futurist books. But apparently it's here now, and, I just think it's wildly dangerous, and I would love to pick your mind because I think the truth is stranger than fiction, and so there's nobody better to go to than a fiction writer and say, how does this one go wrong? Brad Meltzer in a second.
Glenn Beck.
So here's a story I got out of Bloomberg, talking to Brad Meltzer, the author of The Escape Artist. If humans are going to entrust big decisions on computers, how can they ensure that these computers act in humanity's best interest? Amazingly, given the increasing power and persuasiveness of algorithms, it's a question that researchers are just beginning to answer. How can we make sure that they act fairly? To start with, we need to define fair. At a recent conference, New York University, they were asked, should a risk profiler, for example, treat all racial groups equally, regardless of their other differences? Should it acknowledge differences, but focus on achieving similar error rates? Should it correct for previous wrongs? Do some definitions seem good in the short term, but have negative long-term repercussions? What are we headed for, Brad?
I think, you know, what we're headed for, I read this amazing article, and these are the things, you know, why I love talking about, because, you know, these are the things that years ago I got invited by the Department of Homeland Security to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And the reason that I think they brought people like myself in who are fiction writers is they wanted to figure out what's the craziest thing you could do. And what I was fascinated with is I started studying why, you know, when did they start bringing people in like this? How did this happen? And one of the things that they told me and that I found out is there was a conference a few years back of futurists, people who kind of try to fathom what the future is going to bring or really good at figuring out what the future will bring. And the number one thing that they said, what's the greatest threat to the United States right now? And it used to be things like nuclear war, you know, things like that. The greatest threat, according to these futurists now, is a small group of individuals who have just an idea that they can't shake and they're willing to do anything for it. And it's what society is facing right now is the ability of people to a small group, not a country. We're not fighting Russia. We're not fighting the Cold War anymore. We're fighting a tiny group of people. This is, if you saw this article you're talking about, it, you know, it's a group of like a small business is what we're fighting. Who are basically able to influence us. And the article that I read that really scared me is what we lose in all of this, the real thing that dies is truth. That's what disappears because we don't realize anymore. We can't trust what we see.
So how do you solve for that? What do you do to prepare?
I have been thinking of it all weekend. I've been literally thinking, you know, can Facebook take away news? Can you take away politics from it? Can you limit it to just people posting about their kids and dogs in the way that, you know, we know is fair? And the truth is I don't know how. I personally think that this is one of those things, the same way we regulate what the news is on TV, the same way we try to regulate at least certain things, is Facebook can't be the Wild West. It has too much power. And when you have that much power to influence billions of people and the way that they think, you have a problem. You have a real problem. And I think that, you know, when you look at Mark Zuckerberg saying, you know what, this never happened, and then quickly realizing, oh my gosh, this did happen and we need to take, you know, we have to figure out what the consequences are. I don't know if anyone knows what to do, but I would say this to everyone listening, is when you see something on Facebook that's posted, it's so easy to click a like and say, man, I agree with that.
But check it first. Escape Artist is the name of the book, Brad Meltzer.
Glenn,
thanks, Brad.
Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck program.
I want to play the audio here from D.C. council member Trayon White Sr. He is he's on the city council, and it was snowing. He was driving in his car, and he decided to post a video driving and doing a video. But that's not what's
the all unite to ban texting. But
yeah,
God forbid.
Right.
Of course, you can obviously video and make live commentary as a council.
Sure. Here's what he said. Listen.
Man, it just started snowing out of nowhere this morning, man. Y'all better pay attention to this climate control, man. This climate manipulation. And D.C. keep talking about we're a resilient city. And that's a model based off the Rothschilds controlling the climate to create natural disasters they can pay for to own the cities, man. Be careful.
You should be careful of that. I mean, it would say if that's occurring in your area.
Which? The Jews?
The Jews controlling the weather?
The weather?
It's something to be careful about.
Yeah.
That's just a public service announcement from this program.
Right. Okay. I don't think that's true that Jews are trying to control the weather to take over our cities. But
well, he didn't say it was true. He just said you should need to watch out for it. Okay. You know?
So he's apologized. He's apologized this morning, and I want you to listen carefully to this apology.
In response to my social media post on Friday, as a leader, I work hard every day to combat racism and prejudices of all kinds.
Don't think he wrote this.
No? It gets to a point with me, you might believe it. I want to apologize to the Jewish community and anyone that I have offended. The Jewish community have been allies with me in my journey to help people. I did not intend to be anti-Semitic. And I see I should not have said that after learning from my colleagues.
He wrote that line.
So he didn't intend to be anti-Semitic, and he sees now that he should not have said that after learning from his colleagues.
All right, so wait. He's sorry he didn't mean to go after the Jews, but he now realizes that he shouldn't have said that because somebody told him that's a bad idea to say that?
It does appear to be the order of events.
But do you think that means, hey, that was stupid to say, or that's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard?
I mean, maybe you could argue he didn't realize the Rothschilds controlling the weather was an anti-Semitic conspiracy. Like, maybe he just is just a crazy conspiracy theorist and is just anti-Semitic reasons.
He can drive.
He can drive.
And he has access to the internet.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say this was a well-researched post. I mean, he seemingly was doing it off the top of his head he was operating
a motor vehicle.
Listen to it
again for the science purposes here, for the scientific reasons. Listen to it again.
Man, it just started snowing out of nowhere this morning, man.
Snowing out of nowhere.
Y'all better pay attention to this climate control, man. This climate manipulation. And D.C. keep talking about we're a resilient city. And that's a model based off the Rothschilds controlling the climate. To create natural disasters they can pay for to own the cities, man. Be careful.
I'm wondering where he heard that.
I don't know. Maybe on the internet.
Maybe on the internet? Is it possible that he is somebody who follows Louis Farrakhan?
I don't know. That would be a good follow-up question.
Good follow-up question. Where did you learn about the Rothschilds and their weather machine?
And the interesting, he says that it starts snowing out of nowhere, as if the snow goes from the state of there's no snow and then the snow begins, which is also would describe every other snowstorm that's ever occurred. It's always not snowing and then snowing. That's
how just comes out of nowhere. It's actually coming out of the clouds above.
That's
you.
How that works.
It's
a strange observation.
And really, you have a long time to prepare. Like, people in California don't have so long because the rest of the you're not seeing tape of the rest of the country getting that storm.
No,
you get it at the very end. It's traveled all the way across the country.
I will say too, this is only a visual, but for those of you who did not see the video of this, there's like four flakes falling from the sky. It is not snowing a lot. This is the worst climate control effort of all time. The Jews are losing their game. They apparently are not good at this anymore.
They're not good at that.
He goes on, by the way, to say, I have spoken to leaders and my friends at Jews United for Justice, or JUVJ, and they are helping me to understand the history of comments made against Jews, and I am committed to figuring out ways to continue to be allies with them and others. Mm. So there you go.
I think he's learned his lesson. Let me ask you this. Aaron Hernandez, they're now saying he was gay and that he killed this guy in 2013 because he knew that Hernandez was gay.
I've heard this rumor before. Aaron Hernandez, of course, New England Patriots tight end, was convicted of murder, also acquitted of another double murder, I believe it was. I'm getting all of his murders confused, but he did wind up killing himself fairly recently. But they're now saying that it's a gay issue. He was closeted and did not and was afraid he would.
He was angry about it.
Hmm.
Okay.
Is there any evidence to support this theory?
Well, his defense team says. It was clear that this man was gay.
Now, is it okay?
When you have evidence like that.
It was clear?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, would it make a difference in his sentencing?
That's what I wanted to ask.
To be
I thought we would. It would be nice. I couldn't get Kevin Spacey on the phone, but the last time I heard a defense like this was from Kevin Spacey.
You can't get me for Me Too because I'm gay.
Yeah.
That was essentially his answer. Yeah.
Hey, I only did this because I'm gay.
That was the squirrel of essentially his statement.
Yeah.
Look at this instead of the first thing. And by the way, the media went along with that initially. Many of the initial stories was Kevin Spacey comes out as gay, which is exactly what he was trying to do. Instead of it being about him potentially assaulting all of these people, allegedly, and him losing his giant job, and really all of his jobs. Not only House of Cards, but also the Richest Man in the World, or what was that movie that Christopher Plummer wound up taking his role from. And obviously, he's just basically out of work now.
You think this would work for Andrew McCabe? If he just came out today and
went, smart.
I'm gay.
He fired me because I'm gay.
Yeah, I'm gay.
That's a very smart approach. I don't know. It doesn't seem to work. I feel like that worked better at one point. Poor Kevin.
Yeah, do you think? I don't think it should have.
No.
But maybe it did. It didn't work for Kevin Spacey. I don't know. Murder somebody. I'm gay. Yeah, but you murdered somebody.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a trait of gayness.
Here's an interesting set of standards we can all discuss today,
right?
Which is maybe if you're black and if you're gay and if you're Jewish and if you're white, you should be treated the same. Maybe if you commit a crime, you should go to prison for the same amount of time.
Maybe if
you're a politically connected Democrat, you should still get fired if you break the rules.
No.
Maybe the media shouldn't just immediately side with you because you're from a protected group of some sort.
No.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Again, I go back to that Bloomberg article. By the way, Jim Caviezel is going to be with us in studio here in about 20 minutes. The algorithm that they are now designing, we're only beginning to understand, for example, how facial recognition technology tends to misidentify minorities. Real problem if police are using it to search for suspects. The standard procedure is set algorithms loose on people without checking for flaws and almost with little or no mechanism for appeal. So how do we get these machines to act fairly? Well, we have to define fair. Should a risk profiler, for example, treat all racial groups equally, regardless of their other differences? Well, I would say yes.
Hmm.
Now, if it's going to misidentify people because it's misreading features, then that's a problem. But when it comes to, hey, who's the best shot at killing this person? I think as long as we're putting facts in, I don't really care what color they are. White, black, yellow, it doesn't matter to me. Should it acknowledge differences but focus on achieving similar error rates? Should it correct for previous wrongs?
That
would be good.
That's going to be a fun one.
Yeah.
Correcting for previous wrongs. That's a wonderful pathway.
Do some definitions seem good in the short term, but have negative longer repercussions? The right balance seems to be somewhere in the middle. The latest paper finds that if members of a disadvantaged group are given loans at rates higher than in the maximum profit scenario, but lower than the forced equality scenario, they broadly improve their credit scores. This comes at short-term cost to the lender, but is likely beneficial in the longer term as society as a whole becomes better off.
Yeah, one of the things they found was that some groups gave a lot of loans to underprivileged minority groups or whatever to try to be fair. And that fairness led them to getting loans they should not have had, which also led them to defaulting on loans that they should not have had, which wound up hurting them in the long term because they went bankrupt or ruined their credit because they had loans they shouldn't have had.
Yes, but that happening to a few people, that's okay. We can have the algorithm spit out. The algorithm will mean nothing. If an algorithm spits out something that is politically correct, instead of this is what's most likely to happen, then it's of no use. It's of no use. It's just a social justice tool. Oh my, I never thought of it that way. criminal risk scores can turn people into criminals. And Facebook's news feed, sure, they keep people engaged, but they also promote outrage and even catalyze violence. What? No, look, here's the thing. Okay, I think we all really, I mean, I hate to, you know, ask everybody to put that on their big pants here for a second, but Facebook isn't doing any of this. We are. We are. Okay, Facebook is playing off us, but you're smart enough to figure this out, that there's an algorithm that gives you what you want and what you like. See the button that says like? That means, if you're a capitalist, I'm going to give you more of what you like, less of what you don't like. That's capitalism. That's the way this is working. Now, if we were all like, you know, well, I was going to say normal human beings, but I don't think normal human beings are what I thought normal human beings were. If we were at all responsible, we would do our own homework and not just look at the headline and read the first paragraph and then repost it because it reconfirmed our worldview.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of conservatives I've heard that are critical of Facebook and other social media accounts or suppliers, platforms for this, saying like, you know, hey, they need to fix their thing so that X, Y, and Z doesn't happen. But it's really the same argument that the left brings up on Hardee's, right? Like Hardee's is providing a 2/3 of a pound thick burger that's 1,200 calories. You don't have to buy it.
It's exactly the same thing as talk radio. We've got to balance talk radio. We have to fix talk radio. We have to make sure that we treat people like morons. No. Just let the monkey tails fall off all of the morons. That's what we need to do.
Glenn Beck.
A friend of mine, Jim Caviezel, is in with us in just a few seconds. He's in the green room now, getting ready to come on in. He'll be joining us at the top of the hour. Jim Caviezel, of course, played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ. And I don't think he has... Have you seen him deliver a piece of acting that was just, meh? I mean, he's
always good in everything.
He is always great in everything. He's just, I think, one of the best actors of our day. But because he played Jesus, he's paid a heavy price for it. So he's decided to branch out a little bit this time. He's now playing Luke, the Apostle of Christ. This movie is coming out, Paul, the Apostle of Christ, and Jim Caviezel plays Luke, risking his life to visit Paul, who's held captive in the Roman prison. And he'll be talking about that and also his life. And he's a fascinating guy, really fascinating guy. We went to school together. He's just such a good, decent man. He's everything. You know, he's one of those people that you meet and you're like, I wonder what he's like. Exactly the way you think he is. Just really quiet and gentle and peaceful and kind. And he's a really nice guy. So we'll catch up with him here in just a few minutes.
You know, Passion of the Christ only made $611 million worldwide in 2004.
But that's it.
Was that
2004?
Yes, 2004. Now, that should not be confused with the movie Passion, released in 2013, starring Rachel McAdams, directed by Brian De Palma, that made $92,181.
Ah, okay.
A little bit, right. I guess, of the Christ was important.
I guess, it was.
It was an important part
of
that.
May not have been a church film.
Maybe not. Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah. But this was, I mean, you know, this is Mel Gibson. This is the first really big film since, you know, probably Cecil B. DeMille in that genre that was really done right. And look how far the faith films have come now. I mean, the third highest grossing film this weekend is a faith film. I can only imagine. And it's really, really good. So Jim Caviezel joins us here in just a few minutes.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.